Board. My name is Kelvin Conishiro. I am, along with Mr. Aaron Krebs, are appearing on behalf of the petitioner appellees, Clyde Miyake, M.D., and Sharon Lawler, M.D. To begin with, we'd like to thank the court for accepting our application for writ of certiorari in this particular case. We brought the application because we submit that the ICA, in its decision below, has ignored the precedent set by this case, by this court, in the cases of Buck versus Miles and Hayes versus City and County of Honolulu. And based on this failure to even cite those cases in their opinion, we believe that the ICA erred gravely in their determination or in their opinion of the court. More directly, this court has issued or asked counsel to answer a few questions on that particular matter, and I'd like to address those questions. First question being whether a lay medical malpractice plaintiff, as injured person of ordinary intelligence, without particularized medical knowledge or training, whose mental capacity is not affected by the injury or its treatment, must have actual knowledge that a given medical procedure was improperly performed or not medically indicated for his or her condition in order for the claim to accrue where the condition has been properly diagnosed. The clear answer to that, both under Buck versus Miles and in Hayes versus City and County, is no. A plaintiff need not have any actual knowledge of the particulars of the negligence before the claim accrues. If you look at Hayes versus City and County, although not a medical malpractice case, it did address the accrual of the statute of limitations. In Hayes, what this court ruled was that a plaintiff need not know of the particular or the specific breaches of duty before the cause of action accrues for the purpose of statute of limitations. Buck, in a medical malpractice case, goes a step further and says that in a medical malpractice situation where a plaintiff is not required to have any type of a medical expert opinion of that there was a breach of the standard of care before the claim accrues. In fact, in Buck, what the court found was that, and what the plaintiff had argued, was that they only had an unsubstantiated subjective belief that there was a wrong committed. And yet, this court found that that was sufficient to trigger the running of the statute of limitations. Looking at the cases that were cited by the...
Mr. Conishiro. Yes. But in Buck, as a matter of fact, the plaintiffs had obtained the opinions of three professionals indicating that there was a causal connection between the damages and the injury. Isn't that correct?
That's true. And in Buck, what the court found is that that in and of itself was not the requirement. In fact, it was never stated as part of the requirement that the plaintiff obtain such information. All the court realized...
It was relied on, though. They went on and they said, well, you don't need to have
correct
professional opinion, but they pointed out that, in fact, under those facts, the plaintiff had gotten a professional opinion drawing a connection between the injury and the damages.
I understand, and it was noted that in fact the plaintiff had the information, but the bottom line question is whether or not that was a requirement before the statute of limitations began to run, and the court did not find that it was necessary for the plaintiff to have such medical knowledge necessarily that there was some breach of the standard of care.
Well, Mr. Conishiro, the plaintiff went to see a couple of attorneys, actually three attorneys in this case.
Yes, Your Honor.
Mr. Freed and then the law firm of Trucker Fritz and finally Mr. Green.
Correct.
So what did she learn from Mr. Freed?
I think the question is not more of what she learned or what she didn't learn from Mr. Freed. I think that's not part of the record.
What did Mr. Freed tell her, if anything? Do you know?
On the record, no. We are not privy to exactly what Mr. Freed said or didn't say to her because, as I understand in the deposition, it was objected to on the grounds of attorney-client privilege. So that matter was not gone into, so it's not part of the record.
So what about Trucker Fritz?
Trucker Fritz, same thing. The only thing in the record as far as Trucker Fritz is concerned is that she did go and see one time for a consultation to the firm of Trucker and Fritz, I think in October or thereabouts or later in the winter of 1997.
So the state of the record is that the defendants attempted in discovery to ascertain the substance of the communications between the plaintiff and the attorneys that she first consulted. But those attempts at discovery were essentially blocked by the plaintiff herself. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that's in the records. As far as the attempts were, it's in our records. I believe we filed it as part of our supplemental exhibits, which included the deposition excerpts from Ms. Vedina's deposition. I think this was part of our revised Exhibit A to Defendant Clyde Miyake's and Sharon Lawler's motion for summary judgment. This is at the Record on Appeal of Volume 2. I think it begins at page 46. And in that section or the excerpts from the deposition, there are sections where the question is gone into with plaintiff by counsel from our office, and the question is asked, what was told to you, what was discussed with you by Mr. Freed, and the attorney-client privilege was raised, and therefore the question was never answered. So
the question is not what did she actually learn, but it's what she could have learned from these attorneys.
It's what she could have learned. It's also, I think, under the case law, it's what the trigger of the statute of limitations is, when it accrues, is the knowledge that the person has been injured, that the injury is connected with some other person, i.e. the person who may have caused the injury, and that there was some conduct on that part of person, a suspicion of the conduct of that person may be wrongful. Not necessarily the specifics, but the belief that there is something wrong or something wrong happened because of what that person did. And I think in this case, based on the undisputed evidence, all of those elements were present even before Ms. Vedina went to see Mr. Green, and long before that, because we know from
Mr. Conishu.
Yes.
If you don't have anything on the record indicating what was discussed with Mr. Freed or with Mr. Trecker, is this the same situation with Mr. Trecker?
Yes.
Then there's nothing in the record which would indicate that she learned of any causal connection between a duty owed by the doctors and the damages in the record. Isn't that true?
It may not be that she learned it, or we may not know whether or not she learned that from the attorneys, but we know from her own handwriting, from her own admission when she went to the Virginia Mason Hospital for later treatment, that she knew that, one, she had an injury, the pancreatitis. Two, that the pancreatitis was the result of the ERCP procedure, which Dr. Miyake had performed. She knew those two things, at the very least. She also knew, by her own affidavit, that at the time she had the surgery, or thereafter, that in her mind, she did not know that the pancreatitis was a result, or could result, from an ERCP. And therefore, in her mind, she knew all of the elements. She knew, one, that she had an injury, the pancreatitis. She knew, two, that the pancreatitis is related to what Dr. Miyake did, because she knew it was caused by the ERCP procedure, which Dr. Miyake performed. She also knew, in her mind, that something went wrong, because she didn't expect the pancreatitis to be a result of the ERCP, but she knew it resulted from it. So she had all of the requisite elements to start to trigger the statute of limitations, the accrual of the statute of limitations. Whether or not she learned it from her attorneys or she learned it later on is not the point. The point is, on the record in this case, she had that knowledge by her own admissions, both in her affidavit and in what she wrote when she filled out the patient information form at the Virginia Mason Hospital. So what she learned from her attorneys or may not have learned from her attorneys is really of no consequence based on what we know she knew. And I think that's the key in this particular case. If we look at the cases that even plaintiffs cite, the courts in other jurisdictions as well as here, and consistent with Hayes and consistent with Buck versus Miles, require that the patient know of the injury, require that the patient know the connection of the injury and the person or persons to whom that injury is related, but only have a suspicion or an understanding or a belief that a wrongful act or wrongful occurrence happened. That's all they need to know. They don't need to know the specifics of why it was wrongful. They don't need to know how it was negligent. They don't need to know how it is, how the standard of care is breached.
Oh, excuse me, Mr. Concho, that's not the standard in our jurisdiction, though. Reasonable suspicion.
The standard in our jurisdiction is knowledge of the injury, the causal connection of the injury, and the wrongful act.
Yes, not reasonable suspicion.
Well, the knowledge, a reasonable suspicion is just merely a different way of pointing out knowledge as to the wrongful act, how that knowledge is obtained.
The ICA said that the moving papers didn't describe what the procedure was that was involved. Is that true?
The moving papers described the... Oh, you mean as far as what the actual procedure was?
Yes.
In specifics, no. I think the documents that were presented to the court below did not specifically describe the actual
And you had an affidavit
procedure
from the... I guess plaintiff indicating that she didn't know there was a causal connection.
No, the affidavit only said that from the plaintiff's point of view, she did not know of the particular acts being a breach of the standard of care. She knew of the causal connection, but like I said, what she wrote in that patient information sheet at the Virginia Mason Hospital clearly indicates she knew the causal connection. She knew it was a pancreatitis that resulted from an ERCP procedure that was performed by Dr. Miyake. There was no one else performing that particular procedure on her. So she knew the causal connection.
Mr. Kaneshiro, every time there's a bad result in a procedure, are you saying that that necessarily means there's a wrongful act then?
No, and I think the case law points that out. I mean, that is the fine line distinction. Whether you know, just because there is an adverse result of a particular procedure does not necessarily trigger in anybody the statute of limitations, meaning that it doesn't trigger in that person the requirement to start looking for problems. What the case law says is that if that person for some reason has some either a subjective belief that something went wrong, if that triggers them in their minds to believe that they may have a cause, at that point, the statute starts to run. And in this case, that happened because, remember, she goes after the procedure to see two attorneys, at least, before seeing Mr. Green. The two attorneys she goes to see are not just any attorney. She goes to see Mr. Freed, who is a known expert or a known plaintiff's attorney in medical malpractice cases, as well as Trecker and Fritz. And counsel for plaintiff in the oral argument before the in the circuit court admitted that she went to see well-known medical malpractice plaintiff's attorney. She didn't go to see a physician to find out what happened. She didn't go to see a medical consultant of any sort to find out what happened. She went to plaintiff's attorneys. And if you look in the deposition, the question is asked, it is in the record, the question is asked of Ms. Vedina, did you go for consultation for medical malpractice? And she said, if it came to that, yeah. Which meant when she went to see Mr. Freed, in the back of her mind, the thought was, there may have been medical malpractice. Because she said, if it came to that, yeah. Meaning, somewhere in the back of her mind, at the time she sees Mr. Freed, she's already thinking medical malpractice is a possibility. At that point, she has enough of a suspicion, enough of an understanding that she may have a cause of action or a claim for relief, and at that point, statute of limitations starts to run.
What if plaintiff's counsel had not, I presume, instructed his client not to answer the questions in a deposition? And Ms. Vedina had answered the questions, and the substance of her testimony had been, you know, Mr. Freed told me that he'd reviewed the records that I gave him, and in his opinion, the probability of prevailing at trial was 3% on the merits, no negligence. What would that do to the tolling or running of the statute of limitations?
That would not toll the statute of limitations. And the reason for that is, and I'll cite to the court a number of cases that recite in this case that stands for their proposition. First of all, the Kubrick case, United States versus Kubrick, which is the case that's cited in the Jacoby case. In United States versus Kubrick, the Supreme Court of the United States states, if he fails to bring suit because he is incompetently or mistakenly told that he does not have a case, we discern no sound reason for visiting the consequences of such error on the defendant by delaying the accrual of the claim until the plaintiff is otherwise informed or himself determined to bring suit, even though more than 2 years have passed from the plaintiff's discovery of the relevant facts about injury. The U.S. Supreme Court says that even if she gets an opinion from an attorney that says there's no malpractice, that does not toll the running of the statute of limitations. Similarly, in one of the California cases, this case is called Gutierrez. In Gutierrez versus Moffitt, this is at 705 P. 2nd, 886, the California Appellate Court notes that the limitation period, this is at page 320, the limitation period was not affected when counsel told her that there was no probable malpractice, even under California law. The fact that there is a statement by an attorney that says there's no malpractice or no cause of action does not toll the statute of limitations. It does not affect the running of the statute of limitations. Even in one of the cases cited by plaintiffs, the Peterson case, versus Zaleski out of Alaska, I believe. It's 822 P. 2nd, 903. At page 907 in the footnote 5, the court notes, Patterson is chargeable with any negligence on the part of his attorneys for statute of limitations purposes. Insofar as constructive notice and diligent investigation affect the computation of the limitation period, the patient is generally charged with the lapses of attorneys acting on his behalf. That footnote footnotes a statement by the court that it is possible that his lawyers were negligent in failing to review medical records to look for medical malpractice. In other words, even where the attorney to who the patient consults is negligent in failing to go through the records to find medical malpractice, that does not toll the running of the statute of limitations. So whether or not Mr. Freed or Mr. Fritz or anyone else had told the plaintiff that they had no case, that does not toll the running of the statute of limitations under case law.
Mr. Kaneshiro, I assume that you brought up the fact that Mr. Fritz and Mr. Freed were well-known plaintiff's attorneys to support your view that she must have known, or as you said, it was in the back of her mind that she may have had a cause of action. So therefore, there may have been a wrongful act. Is that correct?
Correct.
Then she submitted an affidavit saying that although there was a bad result, she didn't necessarily make the connection that it was necessarily as a result of a wrongful act. Is that correct?
What she says in her affidavit is that she didn't know the specifics. In other words, that too much dye was used, or that it was not indicated, or that the x-rays were failed to be taken. She didn't know the specifics, but she, based on the facts known in the record, she knew that there was something wrong.
And she knew that there was a bad result.
No, she knew that not only there was a bad result, but the bad result happened because of something that may have gone wrong. Because remember, she and her...
Something that may have gone wrong is different from a wrongful act or a negligent act. Is that correct?
I agree that a bad result, as Your Honor had said earlier, a bad result in and of itself does not necessarily establish that there had been any kind of a wrongful act. I agree with that. What I'm saying in this particular case is, not only did she know that there was a bad result, she knew the bad result happened because something may have gone wrong with the surgery. Because
she said that in her affidavit.
In her affidavit, she said that she knew, or in her mind, the pancreatitis, she did not know that pancreatitis would be the result of the ERCP. Therefore, at the time she had the surgery and at the time the pancreatitis occurred, in her mind, the pancreatitis was something that should not have happened.
Okay, we're in accord so far, but does that connect it up to a negligent act?
Yes, because she knew that because it's something that should not have happened, something went wrong. If it was a normal consequence, or if it was a normal complication of the particular surgery in her mind, then, yes, I agree, she may not have known that there was a wrongful act, but in her mind, she knew that the consequences, the pancreatitis, in her mind, was not something that should have resulted if the ERCP had been done properly.
Mr. Kaneshiro, is the record unequivocal that at the very least Ms. Vedina had a subjective belief that her injury resulted from negligent acts?
Yes. Based on what she did, based on what she said in her affidavit, yes, she did have a subjective belief that there was a negligent or at least a wrongful act, something went wrong with the surgery. And based...
You mentioned the Pedersen case.
Yes.
What was in the record that called attention to wrongdoing, a wrongful act?
What was in the record in this particular case?
In the Pedersen case.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It was secondary. Didn't they say that her injury was, or his injury was secondary to the procedure?
Right, but I think the Pedersen case is one of those situations where there was no knowledge of, there was no reason for the patient to believe that there was, one, an injury connected to anything that the doctor did.
See, what I'm looking at is, I guess in essence, would a reasonable attorney, okay, dealing in malpractice cases, looking at these records, records that were given to the attorney, detect that wrongful act?
I assume
in the Pedersen case.
Well, let me put it this way. The record before the court, and before the court below, implies or assumes that the medical information that Ms. Vedina had through the Freed office was the very same information that was presented to or available to Mr. Green's office. In which case, your question is whether or not a reasonable attorney would have. Well, it appears based on the record in this case, if Mr. Freed didn't find it, we don't know whether he did or not. For sure, Mr. Green apparently found something, and that's why this case arose. So there is no change in the information that was available. There is no difference in the information available as far as this record is concerned. So I guess the short answer is, based on the records in this case, there was information there, information available from which one could glean that there was a breach of standard of care, at least for someone to glean that. And I think that is clear on the record in this case. There's nothing else that says that there was any further information that was obtained, further medical records, further whatever that was obtained regarding what happened.
Mr. Kaneshiro, what's the significance of the trip to Washington in between her, was that between her consultation with Mr. Freed and Mr. Trecker, and then her subsequent consultation with Mr. Green?
I believe her trip to a Virginia Mason Clinic or hospital occurred after she had seen Mr. Freed, but before she had seen Mr. Green, and I'm not sure whether or not it was before she had seen Mr. Fritz. It may have been, because as far as the timing of when she saw Mr. Fritz is vague. It just says winter of 1997. Doesn't peg a particular month. We know she went to the Virginia Mason Clinic in October of 1997, so it could, the visit to, or the consultation with the Trecker Fritz firm may have been after that. And as far as what's the significance of it, I think from our point of view, the significance is what she told him she knew at that point in time, which is exactly the causal connection and the injury. So as far as whether or not she went to see the Trecker and Fritz firm as a result of what happened at Virginia Mason, I can't say based on the record. But I think that is not necessarily germane to the particular point in this case, because even if there was some kind of a connection, her knowledge as far as her cause of action, we believe, occurred at the very least when she saw Mr. Freed, and for sure when she was Virginia Mason by her own handwriting as to what she knew.
What in the record, Mr. Kaneshiro, would indicate to a lay person that there was a breach of duty, that there was negligence on the part of her doctors?
I don't think in a medical malpractice situation, there will be situations where a lay person could ever determine from looking at the records themselves that there's a breach of the standard of care.
And how is Ms. Vadina supposed to know that, as required under Jacoby, that there was a violation of a duty owed by the doctors and that her condition was causally connected to that breach of duty?
And that goes back to the initial question by the court. I think she, as a plaintiff or as a patient, need not know specifically that there is a breach of a duty or specific breach of a duty. All she has to know that there's something wrong or somehow she was wrong.
Reverse Jacoby?
I don't think it's to reverse Jacoby. I think the problem with Jacoby is, I think it's a matter of semantics. In Jacoby it says...
Yamaguchi adopted Jacoby also, right?
To an extent, but I think, like I said, it goes to the question of semantics. I mean, to know whether or not there is a negligent act is different from knowing that the act is negligent. Negligent act in that situation...
Case law says violation of a duty. Are you asking that that be altered?
I'm not saying it should be altered. I think that's not the law. I think under Buck versus Miles and Hayes, one need not know that there is specific violation of duty. Because even in Hayes, the plaintiff is arguing, well, I didn't even know that the city and county owed me a duty to warn. And this court said that you didn't need to know that. You didn't need to know that the county owed you a duty to warn, or that the county failed to do it.
The court said there was a general duty that the plaintiff should have known of, although the plaintiff didn't know of a specific duty.
Correct. The court held that the plaintiff knew that there was a general duty. In this case, the plaintiff knows there's a general duty on the part of the physician as part of the physician-patient relationship that runs to her that the physician owes. What she doesn't have to know is specifically what he has to do or what he violated or what standard of care that he violated.
What she has to know, though, is that there's a causal connection between a breach.
That's correct. And I think in this particular case, based on the facts, she knew that. She knew who did the surgery and that she had an untoward effect from the surgery, and it was an effect that she didn't understand to a result from the surgery. It wasn't a normal complication. So at that point, she knew. She knew that there was something wrong, and the statute of limitations starts to run. With that, I see that my time is up, and...
If you would mind, Mr. Kaneshiro, I have one question to ask you. I was waiting for you to get to it, but it wasn't your fault. You didn't get there. But I'm troubled by the payments that were made by Dr. Boyer to Ms. Vadina, the timing of them. They commenced in 1997, and then they end right after the time frame that you say the statute of limitations has run. And I'm wondering whether we can't draw any reasonable inference from stopping of the payments right after the time that you say the statute ran.
That issue, I think, goes more to the question of whether or not estoppel applies. And I think estoppel in this particular case, as a matter of law, would not apply, because estoppel only works in a situation where the plaintiff knows that they have a cause of action. Now, we're claiming she knew. She's claiming she didn't. If she claims she didn't know that she had a cause of action, then estoppel doesn't apply and she can't rely on it. Plus, nowhere in the record is there anything that points to the fact that there was any offer made for Ms. Vadina not to file a cause of action. And that goes back to the question of whether or not in her mind she knew she had a cause of action. Again, she says...
Sure. What do you cite for that proposition that she knows, or that's a requirement that the plaintiff know that there's a cause of action?
I believe it was cited in our answering brief to the... Oh, I'm sorry. It is in our answering brief to the appellate court. Let me get you the page. This is at page 15 of our answering brief. We cite a case called STITT versus Williams, 919 Fed Second 516. which is the case the plaintiffs cite, the Ninth Circuit explained that the equitable estoppel applies when a plaintiff who knows of his cause of action reasonably relies on the defendant's statement or conduct in failing to bring suit. Who knows of his cause of action?
Well, can't we read that argument as an argument in the alternative? Assuming arguendo that Ms. Vedina had the requisite knowledge for the statute to be triggered, the defendants are estopped from relying on the statute by virtue of the payments they made.
I don't believe in that situation one can argue it as an alternative, because it's not an alternative theory, it's an alternative fact. She either knew or she didn't. If she maintains she didn't know, then she didn't know. She can't go back and say, oh, by the way, if the jury found I knew, they're estopped. No. It's an alternative argument.
She won't know what the jury finds until the jury finds it.
But it's what she knew. In her mind, what she's going to testify to is what she didn't know. So she can't fall back and say, oh, wait. If that claim fails, then my knowledge is this. That's alternative facts. She cannot plead, or she cannot take a position of alternative facts. At one point in time, she's going to have to call it. She either knew or she didn't. She can plead alternative theories, but that's not what she's pleading. She's pleading alternative facts.
Mr. Conacher, in the Maoyan Hotel Inc. case, which deals with the lulling of a plaintiff, the court stated that a defendant cannot avail himself of the bar of the statute of limitation if it appears that it has done anything that would tend to lull the plaintiff into inaction and thereby permit the limitation period described by the statute to run against him. That doesn't indicate any requisite that the plaintiff know about the cause of action. It's just, if there is a lulling, then you're barred.
That may be true, it doesn't specifically state it, but in order to have lulling, in order to have someone lulled into belief of not filing suit, that person must have knowledge that they have a suit. Otherwise, they're not lulled into anything.
Well, it's lulling into inaction. If the person is just kind of oblivious because, you know, the lulling aspect of it, you're not even looking at anything because of the effect of lulling.
Then there's no
cause of action.
There's no causal relationship between the lulling acts and the failure to bring the lawsuit.
Well, I guess there would be a difference if the bar was an absolute bar or a mere tolling.
The estoppel, well, that raises a different question. That question goes to whether or not you can have an estoppel as far as the statute of limitations is concerned. And I think under the case law, as Justice Levinson asked about whether or not an attorney's malpractice in failing to tell the person that they have a cause of action, whether that could toll the statute of limitations. By the same reasoning, estoppel would not toll the statute of limitations, because the statute of limitations, once it starts to run, there is nothing that will toll it. There's nothing that will stop it. Absent, I guess, under 657.13, some kind of infirmity. In other words, the patient gets, the plaintiff is either imprisoned or the defendant is out of the country or whatever. I think only in those situations you may have a tolling of the statute of limitations. But other than that, there's no case law that I understand that there is an estoppel for the running of the statute of limitations.
Mr. Conacher, to quote you, you said she didn't know. You said she knew. She says she didn't know. You just said that previously in your argument. Is there then a question of material fact?
No, because the question still is whether she knew or should have known. And I think the record shows that she did know. Whether or not she's going to testify otherwise, I think the record shows that she either did know or should have known, at least at that point in time, that she had a cause of action. So whether or not the estoppel argument, you know, from the point of view of the plaintiff of saying, I didn't know, is still separate from the running of the statute of limitations, because the question still is, on the record, was there evidence that she knew or should have known? We say there was evidence that she knew, but even if you say she didn't know at that point in time, there's sufficient evidence there that she did know, because the medical records that she had in her possession at the time, or at the time Mr. Freed's office got it, based on the record in this case, was the same information she had when she went to see Mr. Green, nothing different. So all the information that was necessary to determine that there was a cause of action, by her consulting Mr. Green was all available to her before that. In fact, 2 years before that. So,
Mr. Kaneshiro, is there still an informed consent issue in this case?
No, because the informed consent issue will still be running along the same lines as the statute of limitations. I mean, it still runs on the same statute of limitations. There's no separate statute of limitation for informed consent.
Footnote one of your supplemental memorandum, you say, for purposes of this appeal, petitioners do not dispute that Vedina did not know that pancreatitis was a risk factor of the ERCP.
Right, that's what she stated in the affidavit.
So you're conceding then that she was never informed that pancreatitis was a risk factor of the ERCP?
I am conceding the fact that that's what she says. Whether she was or wasn't informed, that's a whole different question.
They do not dispute.
We do not dispute that based on her affidavit.
They did not know that pancreatitis was a risk factor of the ERCP.
For the purposes of this appeal, because that's what she stated in her affidavit, and we have nothing to show otherwise at this point. But I'm not conceding that she has an informed consent case just based on that.
That the ERCP allegedly was not indicated, or that too much dye was used.
That's what she claims, and that's what she believes, but I'm not, I mean, for the fact that it's stated in her affidavit.
Well, you do dispute it then. You're saying here today to us that she can say whatever she wants to say, and that's all you're acknowledging. Is that right?
For the purpose of the summary judgment, yes.
But in your brief, you say you do not dispute, not that you don't dispute what she said. You don't dispute that she didn't know.
Well, I guess it is stated in the footnote. We don't dispute for the purposes of the appeal, for the purposes of what we have here, that that's what she stated and that's what she says she doesn't know, because we have nothing in the record to counter that. But in the overall scheme...
As explained below, no such knowledge is necessary.
Right.
What does that mean, then?
As we had said earlier, she, the plaintiff, as a patient, need not know the specific breaches of the standard of care in order for the statute of limitations to run. She does not need to know that too much dye was used. She does not specifically need to know that an x-ray should have been taken. She does not specifically need to know whether or not it was indicated. As in the Hayes case, this court said that the plaintiff need not know the specific breaches in order to have the statute of limitations run. Just in general, that a duty had been breached. So I think that's what we're contending. Whether or not she knew the specifics is not germane to the issue of whether or not the statute of limitation runs.
That's great.
Thank you.
Chief Justice Long, good morning. Justice of the Court, good morning. Let me just say initially that I think the record needs to be clear. I didn't intend to go into the Lulling issue, but it's ludicrous to suggest that they decided, these defendants, to pay her mortgage for years and pay her medical insurance, and it was a loan they just decided to stop about 2 years after the injury occurred. That's just ridiculous. And it's certainly an issue of material fact that a trier of fact should determine whether or not they lulled her into inactivity by paying these things. The way they try to get around it in their moving papers is to suggest it was a loan, an agreement to pay something back. That's a twist of the facts.
What this record shows
on pages 66 and 76, after Ms. Vedina says, "I have integrity," she offered to pay the money back. I'd like to have 12 people in this community decide whether or not she would offer to pay the money back if she believed or knew what these doctors had done to her was negligent. And there was a causal connection between the negligence and her damages. She never knew there was a causal connection for years. What this record shows is, and what she says, they never asked for this money to be repaid. To keep my integrity, I offered to do this. And they paid and they paid and they paid until they thought the 2 years was up. It's interesting that Justice Levinson, most respectfully, asked Mr. Kaneshiro about what if she went to Rick Fried or some other lawyer and they said, you know what, you got a 3% chance. And Mr. Kaneshiro as good a lawyer as he is, immediately went into his briefs, and he cites to you Kubrick. Well, that's nice, because Kubrick's not the law in this state. You have to reverse Jacoby in order to buy that. This is what Jacoby says, and this is page 7 of 11. Under the Federal Tort Claims Act, time runs when a plaintiff discovers the cause and the damage. Plaintiff must discover the fact that the cause is negligent while the clock is running. That has been the law in this state. I hope it will continue to be. And then they say, in Jacoby, there are two differences between Hawaii Revised Statutes 657.7.3 and the FTCA, which causes us to reject Kubrick's interpretation. So why he cited that to you can only mean that he wants you to overrule Jacoby. In looking at this record, this court has to believe that the entire record in this case shows a right to judgment with such clarity that there's no room for controversy. Impossible. Impossible. This woman, when she goes to the hospital and she's told she needs an ERCP, she has pain in the right quadrant, has the procedure done, she goes home, she suffers excruciating pain in the same quadrant, she goes back and she doesn't wake up for about 4 months, she's in a coma. When she gets out of the coma, the doctor, this is Lawler, comes in and apologizes. All Vedina wants to know is why. Why did this happen? How did this happen to me? There's no answer. They refuse to meet with her. She goes to lawyers. She wants an answer. We don't know what this record is what they said. They didn't try very hard to get in that information. They asked a question at the deposition. The lawyer protected his client based on the privilege. They don't go into court and try to compel an answer. She goes to Virginia Mason. That was October of 1997. All she says to the doctors, and that's what's in the record, not what they suggest it says, is that she had an ERCP and she suffered pancreatitis. What does that have to do with negligence? What does it have to do with the breach of the duty and the causal connection? Nothing. An untoward result is...
In light of Buck v. Miles, which at least is this court's, for present purposes, latest take on the relationship between medical malpractice and the statute of limitations, what does it take for the statute to begin to run?
Well, aside from having actual knowledge, the discovery itself, what happened in Buck v. Miles, and I can't look into the minds of the ICA, but certainly that case is dramatically different factually than this case. In Buck v. Miles, that plaintiff knew that she suffered a stroke.
I'm not really asking about the facts of any particular matter. What I'm asking you is, what is your position with respect to what knowledge the plaintiff must have or should have in order for the statute to begin to run?
I think first, there has to be at least some reasonable diligence. I think there has to be something. But that's a fact issue. A jury should determine whether or not any plaintiff...
Does there have to be knowledge of actual negligence?
No, I don't believe there does. There doesn't. But one of the examples would be, if I go in for a tonsillectomy and I wake up and my right arm is off. I mean, if heaven forbid. But I mean, if a reasonable person can only come to one conclusion, the statute runs. The very language of reasonable diligence tells us as lawyers, different people can decide what was reasonable. I look at Jacoby. This court decided Jacoby. The ICA ruled on Jacoby. Miss Jacoby writes a letter about medical malpractice. She goes to the peer review committee. She talks to reporters. And she submits an affidavit and says, you know what? All these things I talked about was because the doctors stopped treating me. They abandoned me. And the court said, you know what? There's a lot of inconsistencies here, madam. But you know what? You have a right to your trial on the facts. Your affidavit at least sets up material issues of fact. That's what happened here. The two cases kind of parallel each other, and that's Jacoby and Miss Vedina. She did everything she could just to get an answer. There were no answers coming, and she has submitted an affidavit. As I said, does she have to know actually that there was a negligent act and damages and causal connection? I don't think she has to know that. There's no requirement to have an expert tell you it happened. There was nothing more she could have done. Does this record, the entire record, establish affirmatively that she could not prevail? There's no way it establishes that. The statute runs, Jacoby says, when there are sufficient critical facts to place the plaintiff on notice of wrong. One of the other questions that we were asked to respond to, question 2B, deals with what constitutes reasonable diligence. And we believe that an action can only accrue as a matter of law if reasonable minds can only reach one conclusion. I mean, to suggest...
I'm sorry, would you repeat that?
Reasonable minds can only draw one conclusion, and we're talking about due diligence. If not, if we...
I'm sorry. The significance of a situation in which reasonable minds could not differ is what?
Well, I believe that's a fact issue. In other words, that would create a fact issue, an issue of genuine issue of material fact. If different people can hear...
The statute of... Are you saying that the statute of limitations only begins to run when the state of the plaintiff's knowledge is such that reasonable minds could not differ as to its significance?
No, I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is when we talk about what constitutes due diligence and the inferences and when the statute runs, what I'm saying is different factors, different facts presented to different people, they can draw different conclusions as to what reasonable diligence constitutes. To say as a matter of law you were not reasonably diligent, I don't think we can do that. We just can't do that, except in situations where, as I said, you wake up and it's really clear there's a wrong site surgery and reasonable minds can only draw one conclusion. But when we start just talking about what is reasonable diligence, how do we ever rule as a matter of law you were not diligent? When we look at the cases that the other side cited for cert, the two cases, Hayes has got nothing to do with this case. There was a legal duty in Hayes for them to put warning signs out before someone dove in the ocean and broke their neck. Hayes waited 7 years until someone told them, you know what, there's a law out there that says they were supposed to post signs. That's not reasonable diligence. They did nothing and waited 7 years. That's not what this lady did. This lady traveled. She went to see, as you said, lawyers that Hayes has suggested she do. She went to Virginia Mason. She did everything she could do to try to find out how it happened and why it happened. Yes, Justice.
How does reasonable inference go in this case? How far does it go when you say, well, you know, she went to see a high-profile, you know, malpractice attorney, gave him all the medical records, same medical records that Attorney Green saw and filed a lawsuit.
You know, it's hard for me to answer the question because it could mean different things to different people. I'm not going to guess at anything other than what's not in this record. Okay. I don't know what they said.
You indicated that Mr. Conachura didn't go far enough to get the information as to what Mr. Creed may have advised your client. Were you at the deposition and...
I didn't. It was someone from my office. I think Ms. Kagawa actually defended that deposition, and she did a marvelous job.
So he could have gotten that information.
I don't know if he could have eventually, but at least they should have tried. The way I see this case respectfully to the justices is this way. If this court were to rule as a matter of law that Ms. Vedina failed to exercise reasonable diligence, then we go back to the proposition of all the money they paid her, how altruistic this doctor was to pay all this money from their joint account, and whether or not that lulled her into inaction. That's a legal issue as to whether that happened. The court, a jury has a right to decide that factually. Now, if the court decides that, you know what, she was reasonably diligent, she did as much or more as Ms. Jacoby did, we don't have to worry about lulling or anything like that. It's one or the other. Either she exercised reasonable diligence and the statute never accrued, or she didn't and we have a lulling issue. It can't be both ways. It's one or the other. We don't have to rely on each one of those legal propositions because that's what they are.
Mr. Green, what about the defendant's position that in order for your client to rely on equitable estoppel, she would have had to know that she had a cause of action and relied on these payments to forgo filing suit?
I don't believe that she would have to know. I think it's a question of whether she decided not to go any further. In other words, if she had a mere suspicion, and that's all it was, because she has no idea that pancreatitis is the result of a negligent act. She just got it. And she tells the people of Virginia Mason, you know, I had this ERCP, I got pancreatitis. There's nothing to cast any doubt on the medical procedure. There's always, from time to time, we see bad results. It doesn't mean there was medical negligence. But certainly, when this woman has lost everything, including her health, and they volunteer to pay her mortgage and her insurance, in fact, they've got the payment cards at the doctor's office of their home, and they keep paying, and then they pull the plug January of 2000, and she doesn't find out until May, they're foreclosing on her house, that's an absurdity. But 12 people need to decide that. This is not a case based on Jacoby. As a matter of law, we can say that this woman cannot prevail. That this record presents such clarity that there is, that as a matter of law, she should not be able to have her day in court. It's either the tolling that's based on equitable estoppel, the lulling based on equitable estoppel where they let her down the path for over 2 years, or the fact that you can rule that she exercised reasonable diligence or she didn't. There's no question, comparing this case, her reasonable diligence to Jacoby, it's almost on all fours.
So, Mr. Green, in your view, the outcome of the appeal holding the lulling issue aside turns on whether there is a genuine issue of material fact regarding Ms. Vedina's exercise of reasonable diligence.
I believe so. And where I get that from is looking at what Jacoby said regarding the affidavit that was filed by Ms. Jacoby.
Mr. Green, the defendants point to Hayes and Buck, and they say, those cases say, all you need to do to start the statute of limitations running is that the plaintiff has within her knowledge the facts which would constitute a cause of action, and not necessarily that there was a breach of duty or that all these facts would amount to a cause of action. Well, how do you respond to that?
I can only look at what our statute of limitations provides regarding these cases. And it deals with, first, there has to be a negligent act that's known to the plaintiff. There has to be a breach or damage and causal connection between those things. When I look at the cases that they cite, those cases are easily distinguished from this case. But that plaintiff admitted that the stroke she suffered was the result of the improper ingestion of medication that the doctor gave. Hayes has got nothing to do with this case. Hayes, as I said, dove into the ocean, and he's blaming that fact that there were no signs up and there was a lot of post signs.
Mr. Green, there is a difference, isn't there, between knowledge of an act that may or may not ultimately be found to be negligent and knowledge that the act was negligent.
I agree with that.
What does it take?
I agree with that. And
what
I don't have...
Which of the two does it take or is sufficient to trigger the running of the statute of limitations?
Can we say... I don't know. But the reason I think I don't know is because it takes 12 people to tell me that. Can we say as a matter of law, this proposition means...
No, I quite agree with you that having never been asked, we don't know what the 12 people would answer. But as a legal matter, for purposes of taking note of the sounding of the starting gun for statute of limitations purposes, is it sufficient that the plaintiff merely be aware of the act, or is it necessary that the plaintiff be aware that the act was negligent?
I think it depends what the act is. Mere suspicion that, you know what, should this really have happened unless someone did something wrong, that's not enough to trigger anything, in my humble opinion. It's a question of what the act is. If it's a wrong-site surgery, it's pretty clear, I would think, that reasonable minds can only come to one conclusion. There was negligence, there was a damage, and there's a causal connection. All elements have to be present. Ms. Medina never had a clue about any causal connection.
Let me ask you this hypothetical.
I'm not trying to tap dance around it.
I don't believe otherwise.
All right, Your Honor.
Suppose the defendants in this matter had been unsuccessful in obtaining summary judgment. Suppose the matter had gone to trial. And suppose after a full trial, no directed verdict, the jury returns a defense verdict.
Heaven forbid.
Heaven forbid. Does that mean that the statute of limitations never began to run?
Well, first of all, it depends what issues are tried, and it depends what's on the special verdict form. But obviously, if the jury, the way this case would go in, this jury, in order to find for them, would have to find, I believe, first of all, that the statute of limitations ran. That she either was aware of the negligent act.
Well, let's assume for the sake of the question that your case is not a slam dunk on the merits, right? And the statute of limitations is not the outcome dispositive issue. But on the merits, there's a defense verdict. Does that mean the statute of limitations never began to run?
I don't know that I can get that far, because if one of the decisions on the special verdict form, I think they have to answer that. I don't think we can get to a defense verdict without that question being asked. It's hard to get out of my mind.
The reason I ask my question is that the one objective measure of non-negligence is a defense verdict. Isn't that so?
Yeah, it is.
So if, as a matter of law, there was no negligence, there could be no negligence of which the defendant could have knowledge. And if there was no negligence of which the defendant could have knowledge, how is it possible that the statute of limitations ever began to run?
You know, I'm not being condescending. That's a great question.
I'm sorry?
I'm not being condescending. That was a great question. I never even got there. In thinking through this for 5 years, it is true. If there was a defense verdict, inferentially, when they're saying, you know what, they never did anything wrong, that the trier of fact believes, by a preponderance of the evidence, there was no negligence, then hypothetically or theoretically, then there was no reason for the statute of limitations to run. But I'd like to come back in about
an hour
and give you the
by answer. Your argument, metaphysically, the statute of limitations could not possibly have begun to run. Isn't that right?
It seems that way.
So the proposition that the plaintiff would have to know that the act was negligent would not be inconsistent with your position.
No. I think
if you look at Jacoby, it talks about the breach of a duty, which implies that the plaintiff would have to know that there was a negligent act.
I think, you know, one of the questions that we were asked to respond to is whether a plaintiff has to have actual knowledge of the wrong. And what that conjures up in my mind is that some expert told them that, you know what, there was medical negligence here, there was a breach in the standard of care. I don't know that we've come that far. I know that there are, what Jacoby says is, either actual knowledge, did they discover the negligent act, and obviously the causal connection, or based on reasonable diligence, should they have done that? I cannot envision, respectfully, other than what I've said many times this morning about wrong site surgery, how we could ever say as a matter of law, someone exercised or failed to exercise reasonable diligence. What is reasonable to one person may not be reasonable to someone else. But to say as a matter of law, someone failed to exercise reasonable diligence, I get back to the proposition that reasonable minds can only come to one conclusion before you can say that. And that's what makes sense to me. My light is on, but as I said, I didn't want to leave Justice Duffy when you asked about this tolling. I they have a right to defend their clients vigorously, and they've done a pretty good job for years, but someone needs to decide why this money was paid and what effect, if any, it had on Ms. Fadina doing nothing until the year 2000. Thank you for hearing me. It's a pleasure to see you all again.
Mr. Fincher, how much time?
Yes, one time.
Go ahead. Wait, how much time did you reserve?
5 minutes.
All right, go ahead.
Let me just address a couple of issues. First, the question that Justice Levinson asked, whether or not the ultimate question is decided by the jury. In a medical malpractice case, whether or not there is a breach of the standard of care is not a fact. It's an opinion by physicians. And then, as the Kubrick Court, the Supreme Court, it comes down to one expert against another, one opinion against the other, in which someplace, sometime, either the court or the jury, whoever the trier of fact is, will determine who's right, who's wrong. So, to say that a plaintiff needs to know that there was a breach of the standard of care, I agree. It can never happen because that's a question of opinion. That's to get a medical testimony. And in Buck versus Miles, this court said, you don't need that. A plaintiff does not need that to have the statute of limitations run. Now, Mr. Green said, well, for you to accept the propositions I stated in Kubrick, you'd have to overturn Jacoby. That's not true. The propositions stated in Kubrick are different from what the ICA rejected or quarreled with in Jacoby. But speaking of Jacoby, let me just bring this point up. Remember in Jacoby, the ICA says, well, we don't like the Kubrick proposition as to when statute of limitations run. We like to follow the California case. And they cited Wozniak. Well, the law in California, as it stands today, is cited in that Jolly versus Eli Lilly case. And in California, as to statute of limitations, the law is stated as such. Under the discovery rule, the statute of limitations begins to run when the plaintiff suspects or should suspect that her injury was caused by wrongdoing, that someone has done something wrong to her. That's the law in California. If Jacoby is adopting California law, that is the law in California today. And it's not one with
but
the plaintiff.
Jacoby didn't adopt Jolly or Jolly, did it?
No.
And then you're quoting from Jolly, is that right?
Jacoby said that they were going to adopt the California standard, the California.
What California case was that?
They were citing to the Wozniak case.
Right, not Jolly or whatever.
Jolly, but the Jolly case
is whenever the plaintiff discovers or should have discovered. It doesn't say when the plaintiff suspects or should have suspected. Is that correct?
That's true, but the California statute also has language almost identical to the Hawaii statute. The statement in Jolly is not...
Have we ever interpreted it to mean reasonably suspects?
I believe in the Buck versus Miles, in that situation, the plaintiff had a subjective, unsubstantiated belief that she had a claim, and that was enough.
Are you saying that in Buck, this court used the word suspects, reasonably suspects?
In that case, what I'm saying is that...
No, just answer my question. Did the court use the words reasonably suspect?
No, not reasonably suspect. In Buck versus Miles, the court found that the plaintiff had a subjective, unsubstantiated belief. And that was found to be enough to start the running of the statute of limitations. So whether it's reasonable suspicion or reasonably suspects, subjective unsubstantiated belief is synonymous to a suspicion or a belief.
Do any of our cases say that the plaintiff's knowledge must be of the alleged negligence.
No, that's why I go back to the point about the semantics. The cases simply state that they must have knowledge of the negligent act. The act itself that is negligent, not that the act itself is negligent or it was there was negligence, but that of the act which is alleged to be negligent. And
so
I think
the
that's
plaintiff can't know that the act is negligent until a trier of fact says that the act is negligent. Isn't that so?
But that's the point. The statute of limitations starts to run because what it does is it now tells the plaintiff, you do your investigation, you find your experts, you find your information sufficient for you to go to a court. The statute gives you 2 years from the date you knew or should have known, or at the outside, even if there's no way for you to know, there's a statute of repose of 6 years. But the point is, the plaintiff does not need to know before the statute starts to run that there is a breach of the, or particular breaches of the standard of care. In other words, how it's breached. Because especially in a medical malpractice situation, generally the patient would not know that without consulting with a medical expert. And even then, it doesn't establish a breach. It's just the opinion of one medical expert. And that's the point I think Justice Levinson brought up. The ultimate finding of negligence will have to go to trier of fact, but that's not what triggers the statute of limitations. Statute of limitations is triggered so that the plaintiff is now put on notice and put on the duty and obligation to start working up their case. It's not every case
with
goes
respect
trial.
To when, excuse me, with respect to when statute of limitations starts to run, that's generally a question of fact, isn't it?
It may be a question of fact.
No, it's generally a question
of
fact.
It is generally stated in the cases as a question of fact, but it is not foreclosed that as a matter of law it can be determined on the record. Now, like anything else, and that's why we have summary judgment motions. The other point I wanted to bring up was just the idea of reasonable diligence. In this particular case, the ICA found that the reasonable diligence went to finding out whether or not there were specific acts of negligence, not as to causation, et cetera, or as the relationship between the injury and the allegedly negligent act. And that's what the Jacoby court found that was a question of fact, because in the Jacoby case, the affidavit by the plaintiff was that she did not become aware that her condition and ailments complained of while under treatment at Kaiser hospitals were directly related to the treatment she had received from defendants until April 1976. In other words, in Jacoby, the question of fact raised by affidavit was no knowledge of the causal connection. She knew she had an injury, but she didn't know the causal connection. So that doesn't necessarily go to the question of reasonable diligence. And finally, I'd like to bring up the point about estoppel that Chief Justice Moon asked about. In the Malwian Hotel case, under the facts of the case, the party who was asserting the lulling, the Supreme Court noted that the stipulations clearly show that Napili Kai, who was the party asserting the lulling, gave notice to Austin Smith of its claim and informed the latter that such claim would be asserted against it in a cross-claim. So on the facts of that case, the party asserting the lulling did know that they have a claim. In fact, they notified the other side, we have a claim and we're going to assert the cross-claim, but because of the acts of the defendant, failed to bring the cause of action. So lulling or estoppel requires the plaintiff or the person asserting it that they have a claim and that for the reasons of the acts of the defendant, they are precluded or they have foregone bringing that claim. It's not a situation of I didn't know I had a claim and et cetera, as they're trying to claim in this case.
And then it's your position that the plaintiff's averments in her affidavit established the requisite knowledge?
Yes. She had the requisite knowledge of the act itself, i.e. the ERCP procedure done by Dr. Miyake. She also knew that as a result of that act, she had a pancreatitis, which she, in her mind, did not expect as a result of the particular surgery. She also knew of the pancreatitis and the subsequent injuries from that. So she had all the requisite knowledge. She knew of the act itself, i.e. the surgery. She knew of the person doing the surgery. She knew of the connection between that surgery and her injury, i.e. the pancreatitis.
So equitable estoppel is an issue in this appeal.
Not as part of her claim, because on the equitable estoppel claim, she's saying, I didn't know anything about these claims. So she cannot raise
equitable estoppel. Assuming you're correct, that she did know, as reflected in her affidavit, then equitable estoppel is a possibility.
If she, well, I guess if she recants her affidavit and says otherwise, then it becomes an issue. But right now, her affidavit stands.
Thank you, Counselor.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Take this matter under advisement.